It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. People work hard to become American citizens. They study English, the Constitution, United States history, and some, like Simon Majumdar, study the food.
So when I wanted to look at becoming an American, and it was a decision, you know, I'm a very proud Brit, as you can tell from my accent, and I was a green card holder. And I could have stayed here forever like that, but I really wanted to become part of this extraordinary country and a full part. So before I made that rather big decision, I wanted to go and meet as many Americans as possible. And I think sharing a meal with someone, you know, breaking bread, tells you something about a community and people that you will never get any other way. And it certainly proved to be the truth.
More from Simon Majumdar, the rise of poke, and underground tea sipping in Montreal. This hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Writer Rowan Jacobson infiltrated a secret society in Montreal. It has a free-for-all competition. In fact, its leader, who Rowan only refers to as Kay. When the leader was describing the group, he says, "Think Fight Club." Well, Rowan got the story for Vice magazine, and he's here to tell the tale. Rowan, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Lynn.
Now I've got to give away what we're talking about. Okay, the title of your piece is "Getting Drunk on Tea Infusions with Montreal's Underground Connoisseurs." What are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about tea, but it's not quite the tea that we all grew up with. So this is, it took me a few years to really to penetrate these underground tea circles, but the hardcore tea addicts out there, or tea hipsters, you might call them, drink tea in a completely different way than we tend to think of tea being drunk here in the U.S. They drink tea almost like espresso. It's very intense, lots more tea leaves, and very little water, about what you would drink in an espresso cup. And they drink cup after cup after cup. And some of these guys, like the ones that I was hanging out with, go deep into the night doing that.
And do they bring their own teas, or are these teas from a particular tea shop?
Well, all over the place. So, yeah, when Kay, the ringleader, when I finally invited me into it, he said, "Think Fight Club." And what that means in this case is that they all want to basically blow away the other guys. So some of the teas were from this high-end shop in Montreal, mm-hmm. That Kay runs, but others were special things that they had sought out. A lot of the best teas are really hard to find. You have to have some connection in China or Taiwan. And once you have one of these great teas, which are insanely expensive, then you sort of save it and show it off to your friends. So this night was all about everybody bringing stuff that you weren't going to be able to find anywhere else and showing off.
So set the scene for us. I mean, where are we? What do these people look like? Who are they? And how is the tea brewed?
So, okay, this is in Montreal in the Latin Quarter, which is kind of the bohemian district in Montreal. And I got the invite and said, come after hours, right? That's the name of this club. So dark was falling, and I showed up at the shop, and they let me in. There were a few people in there already. They locked the doors, pulled the drapes, then a few other people would come and knock on the door, and they'd let those in. And this group was, if I describe them, one thing I've noticed about tea hipsters is they tend to be, they're mostly guys, they tend to be very skinny and kind of have like this sunken-eyed look. The best way I can describe them is that they all look like they stumbled out of a Wes Anderson film. Okay. So there was a lot of French. There's mixed with English, so it was kind of intimidating for me. But I sat down at this table, and there were all these kettles, these electric kettles boiling, like six of them going at once, and tons of strange little baggies with dried herb in them, all over the table, and people were pulling them out of their pockets and stuff. So it definitely felt like I was sliding into this strange drug subculture that I had no idea existed.
So tell me about specifically some of the teas that you were tasting.
Okay, so we started off with a white tea, which is a very, very light tea. It's made with just the new buds of the tea plant when it, and the tiny little first leaves when it's budding out. So it's super mild. And that was definitely more of just like a warm-up to get us going. But then as the night progressed, we would go to greens and then oolongs. And then toward the evening, we shifted to pu'ers, which are kind of like the holy grails of tea. They're aged for decades sometimes, very, very expensive. And they have an intense, deep flavor that, if I had to describe it, I would say it's like, it tastes like things that grow in the dark. You know, it's very weird.
What I remember about pu'er is they come in balls or in little patties. They don't look like tea leaves. They look like a little cake or something.
Right. That's the tradition, is to press them into the little bird's nests, right, which are called tuo cha. And then they're also pressed into these little, like, 250-gram frisbees, like little half-pound frisbees, uh-huh. And you break off a little chunk of it, just like with hashish, for example, and just brew that little chunk. And, yeah, it takes you to a different place. So this was, I'd always liked tea, but I had not known that tea could take you to these ethereal realms.
You quote Kay, and Kay says, "With great teas, I always look for that special feeling. Westerners taste from the neck up, but in Asia, they taste with their whole body." And then he says, nice bib on that one, as he's tasting the tea, tracing the chi down his chest. Was this the sensation that your entire body was being affected?
Absolutely. As the cups of tea build up, you really do start to realize that you're thinking differently about your body and about time even. Like, one thing I realized is that coffee is all about like the future. It's a very entrepreneurial drink where you drink it and you're like scheming for the future. And the more tea you have, the more you just sort of like leave all the worldly concerns behind and get in this big little bubble of the present, which is really nice.
Sounds amazing. Does the perception of reality keep changing in that way? I mean, does it keep evolving?
It does, and it's all about time. Your sense of time just keeps changing, and you get very happy, right? Because you actually have quite a bit of caffeine percolating in you by that point. And so you do, you get lost in this little space, which I think is why tea has always been associated so closely with meditation and Buddhism in the East.
This is really heading into, as you said, a completely different realm.
Yeah, it took me a while to make that flip in my mind, because I was really coming from what you might call a wine perspective. When I tasted things that were supposed to be really good, I was trying to figure out what those flavors were in my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And the tea guys, that's almost beside the point, what it tastes like in your mouth. Like, if it tastes good, if it smells good, great. But they call it the echo sometimes. Like, after you've swallowed, what's the echo? How does your body feel from that experience? And the echo can even come up into your head. And so I had to learn to just think differently and not pounce on the flavor in my mouth and just let the experience kind of evolve.
Unforgettable, right?
Unforgettable. It's changed my life. I am a hardcore tea convert now.
I have to ask you this. Can you tell us who Kay is?
All right. I think he'd be fine with a reveal. So his name is Kevin Gascoigne, and he runs a shop in Montreal called Camellia Sinensis, where I get most of my teas. And actually, this is a great time to do so, because the Canadian dollar is really in the tank right now. So it's a good time to order from Canada.
Hey, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Rowan Jacobson's article on tea tasting was published in Vice magazine. Rowan's latest book is The Essential Oyster. Now, for an unusual tea recipe, take a look at our new video with Indian chef Raghavan Iyer. He shows us how to make his delicious recipe for tea-infused potatoes. Now, can you imagine? It's really simple, and trust me, it's really good. Find it at splendidtable.org. Poke, Hawaii's beloved raw fish salad, has hit the mainland big time, and it's definitely worth a try. Now, the traditional take is essentially raw fish, fresh, of course, diced into small pieces and dressed with the likes of everything from soy sauce and ginger to wasabi and seaweed. It could not be simpler. And simple always invites improvisers. Chefs and fish lovers are having a wonderful time with poke. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, got the details from Martha Chang. She's a longtime resident of Hawaii and has written the Poke Cookbook.
Hey, Martha, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
So tell me what poke means.
Poke, the word itself, all just means to cut or slice crosswise. But obviously here in Hawaii, we mean it as like the raw fish salad that we eat everywhere.
It's everywhere. I mean, when we were in Hawaii, we saw it in gas stations. We saw specific little poke stands.
Yeah.
So where does it come from? What's the heritage?
Well, the roots come from the native Hawaiian preparation. So back when they would just get raw fish and season it with some sea salt that they dried in the sun, some inamona, which is crushed roasted candle nut, and limu, which is seaweed. And that was basically it. And we kind of eat a version of that these days on the islands. We call it limu ahi poke. But what's really popular these days is the ahi shoyu poke. And that kind of evolved around the 70s when all the descendants of the plantation workers, the Koreans, the Japanese, the Chinese, kind of influenced the mix and added sesame oil and shoyu.
So it's a really pretty recent dish.
Yeah, relatively. That's what's funny is like the word poke, you know, obviously existed a long time ago, but it wasn't really associated with what we know now until about the 70s.
Well, we are seeing it more and more on the mainland, and there are some pretty crazy variations. But your book really lends itself to making it at home. You think that's the best thing to do?
I think so. I think if you can find really fresh fish, then it's a great way to prepare it. And also, even actually, if you don't have fresh fish, you can substitute all kinds of vegetables or tofu because that shoyu sesame oil and the onions, it's just a great combination. It's almost like a, I don't want to say mother sauce because that sounds too fancy, but it just works so well with so many things.
And what would you consider an entry-level poke recipe for us?
Definitely the shoyu ahi poke. I mean, there's a reason why it's so popular. It's six ingredients, that's it, and you're chopping it up and throwing it together. It comes together in like 15 minutes or so, and there's no cooking involved. You cut the ahi, which is usually yellowfin tuna, into cubes, and then you throw in some sliced, really thin sliced yellow onion, thinly sliced scallions, a little bit of soy sauce, and some sesame oil, and if you like it, like just a touch of heat through sambal.
And that's it. It almost sounds like a salsa in many ways, you know, like a rough chopped salsa. It's really interesting.
Yeah, maybe definitely a bigger cube, but yeah.
maybe a bigger spoonful. And then what about some ideas for some variations?
So there's a restaurant here in town called Mudhen Water, and they did a beet poke, which uses basically the same shoyu and sesame oil, but applies it to beets instead of the ahi. And the great thing is that the beets are almost even the same color as the ahi.
Exactly. It looks the same. It's very interesting. And cooked beets,
yeah.
Right?
Yes, cooked beets.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
I have noticed that there are a lot of opportunities with poke to use unusual ingredients that you can find, like that fermented plum that the Japanese use, ume,
yes.
Is that what it's called?
Umeboshi.
Yeah, so give me one using that.
So there's the pineapple one, which is basically pineapple, shiso, and ume. There's a little tiny hole in the wall poke place, which are, of course, people's favorites here
right,
on the
right.
islands, that does an ume shoyu poke. And I love that sauce. And it also reminded me of here on the islands, we like to eat pineapple with lihing powder, which is a dried plum powder. So it's kind of tart and sweet and a little bit salty.
That sounds just delicious.
Yeah, it's super good. It's very good cold, too, like on the beach.
So when do people eat poke in Hawaii? I mean, is this a lunch thing? Is it a dinner? Is it a starter?
I'd say it's usually on the islands, we eat it as a shared appetizer. And it's everywhere from potlucks to tailgates to weddings to pauhana, like after work you're getting together with friends with like beer and poke. It's just everywhere. We have it at Costco, we have it all the supermarkets. So and lately we are eating it as like a lunch, kind of over rice, But really, I think the way we really eat it here is just like kind of the way you'd eat chips and salsa, like you were kind of saying.
Oh, you are so lucky to have that fresh seafood. It's wonderful.
Yeah, we are.
So, Martha, do you have any thoughts about why poke has become so popular outside the island?
I think it's kind of gone the way of a lot of immigrant food has. I think there were a lot of Hawaiians and locals. So when we say Hawaiian here, it means Native Hawaiian. And we use locals for people born and raised in Hawaii but don't have Native Hawaiian blood.
Mm-hmm.
So when they moved to the mainland for work and they were homesick and they had poke. So there's like this tiny little shop in San Mateo that makes poke for homesick Hawaiians, and they have for a really long time. Like, I remember that growing up, actually, when I grew up in the Bay Area. But what you're really seeing now is also this same sort of thing when, like, you know, there's these chains who are kind of trying to make money off of it, the same way that kind of Domino's makes pizza. And it kind of has evolved from what it was originally, because now you've got it with pears, and we've seen it with raspberries. It's on top of like a kelp noodle salad on the mainland. And I think it's, people are trying to capitalize on the Chipotle model, the fast casual. And it really lends itself well to that. It's just really kind of evolved, though, I think, from what we eat here.
Which is interesting to me that you still there are eating the very simple shoyu ahi, you know?
Yeah, I think here in Hawaii, we like what we like. And sometimes they say some of the dining here is almost like this postcard from the 60s or 70s for the really traditional places that are still around.
I love that about Hawaii.
Yeah, me too.
It's such a crazy, wonderful food scene. It's very, very interesting. Martha, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Martha Cheng is author of the Poke Cookbook. You can find her recipe for the classic shoyu ahi at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the man who ate his way across America to figure out what being an American really means. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. When Iron Chef judge Simon Majumdar decided to become an American citizen, he knew he needed to learn more about his soon-to-be-adopted country. But he didn't only open a history book. Instead, he undertook a grand cross-country journey. It was about food and drink and the people who make them. And he even got his hands dirty. He made cheese in Wisconsin, brewed beer in Washington State, cooked for a tailgate party in Texas, and a whole lot more. He writes about his discoveries in his book, Fed, White, and Blue, Finding America with My Fork. And he spoke with our correspondent, Joe Yonan, food and dining editor of The Washington Post.
Simon, I love your book. And when you set out in your book to find America, why did you decide on food as the path?
Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed the book. You know, food has always been a central part of my life and my family's life. And it's always the way we've gauged just about everything we do. And every reference we have in our family, and I'm sure a lot of people are like this, is we can say to each other, oh, do you remember when we went here? And the family go, oh, not really. And you go, oh, yeah, you do. We remember. We ate this. And then everybody remembers. So food is one of those great signposts of our life as Bengalis. My father's from Calcutta. My mother was from Wales. You know, I'm from England. It's one of the ways we signposted. So when I wanted to look at becoming an American, and it was a decision, you know, I'm a very proud Brit, as you can tell from my accent, and I, you know, I was a green card holder, and I could have stayed here forever like that, but I really wanted to become part of this extraordinary country and a full part. And so before I made that rather big decision, I wanted to go and meet as many Americans as possible. And I think sharing a meal with someone, you know, breaking bread, tells you something about a community and people that you will never get any other way.
So what preconceived notions, before you started out, did you have about America and American food?
Well, I'm not sure that I had certainly any negative preconceived notions, but I didn't know that I was going to meet the extraordinary number of people. And also, I didn't realize how much I'd have in common. You know, we often sit in these very polarized times and think, well, here I am in the West Coast, and I'm a very liberal guy. I'm going to have nothing in common with someone down in the Deep South. And yet, I found the more I traveled around this country, the more the same we are than we are different. And so that was the biggest surprise, I think, to me.
Yeah, I mean, you were coming at this as a consummate outsider. Do you think that affected how you approach things and how people reacted to you?
Well, I hope I took a very open-minded view, and I think I was given more opportunities because of my profile on social media. But I think people were just a bit almost surprised that I would want to come and share their experiences, because I think what happens sometimes, we don't realize how good we are. We're looking at all the dark sides and we're looking at our arguments, you know, politically or religiously or whatever right now. And sometimes I think you need an outsider to come in and go, you know what, actually, this is a pretty great place. And I started going into my journey with that thought. And I came out of it even more inspired about what I think America is. And I still think I'm the perfect example of what America can be, in the sense that here I was, a 40-something-year-old Brit who had a nervous breakdown, traveled around the world, met my wife, who was from L.A., moved over here, ended up writing books and being on the Food Network. And that's a genuine American story. But I found lots of those as I traveled around the country.
You use social media quite a lot to determine where you would go, right?
I really did. And it's a great resource. So I went on there and said, hey, folks, what should I do? And literally in their thousands, the invitations came. And it still goes on every year. My wife and I do this trip called Give Us a Bed, I'll Cook You Dinner, which we do on Twitter as a hashtag. And people invite us all over the country. We go and stay with them and we cook them a meal as a thank you. And it's just our way of meeting as many Americans as possible.
You're absolutely welcome to come to Washington, D.C., and I will take you up on that offer.
Anytime.
So the book is a lot about, of course, so much about food, but also so much about people. Can you tell us about some of the characters you met along the way?
I actually got invited to share a Sabbath meal with a Jewish family in Overland Park in Kansas City. But at the same time, the gentleman who invited me said, oh, and while you're here, there's actually a kosher barbecue festival going on. And that's where you go, oh, okay, who knew? So I was invited by the organizer, who's this remarkable chap called Mendel Siegel. He's a Lubavitch rabbi, and he is a barbecue nut. He makes his own barbecue rubs, his own kosher barbecue sauces, all of which are rather good. And I got invited to this rather fantastic event and judged it, 40 different teams. And it's all done under the Kansas City Barbecue Society umbrella, but it keeps absolutely kosher rules. So the meat is prepared on a Thursday and then kept in a cooler. Everyone then goes off to celebrate the Sabbath. A rabbi will come out and look in the stars in the sky and say, there are three stars in the sky. Now you may start cooking. And forgive my pronunciation, but the mashgiach will go and light all of the fires so they can start together. And then what happens the moment they do that, there's the first pop of a beer bottle, and it's like any other barbecue competition you go to. obviously not cooking with pork, cooking with turkey and beef. And so Mendel was one of the great characters. Another wonderful, wonderful character, and this is also vaguely related to barbecue, but I was invited to an eating competition in Philadelphia called Wing Bowl, which is one of the craziest competitions. 26,000 people in the stadium where the 76ers play. At 6 o'clock in the morning on a freezing day, watching 25 people eating wings to win $20,000. And I was invited by this guy called Jamie the Bear McDonald, who now runs a great barbecue restaurant up in Hartford, Connecticut. But he was extraordinary. He won the competition by eating something like 400 chicken wings, if I remember correctly, in half an hour, which just boggled, mind-boggling. But he was using that money and money from other eating competitions to put his kids through college and to fund this new business that he was starting. And that, to me, was another great American story. It was about finding something that you do brilliantly well and using that to fund your American dream. And I think that kind of spirit in America of improvement, you know, moving forward all the time, is something that I found constantly throughout this country. And I found it in lots and lots of different communities.
So at the end of the book, you have a list of your top 10 best eats of the journey. Looks like your editor wanted you to do that.
They always do.
Right. Tell us about some of your favorites on there, Simon.
Well, I think some of those meals on the list are really just because the food was delicious. And others, I think, are because they were either surprising or they had a particular personal appeal. One of them was a cheese in Wisconsin, which I actually helped to make at Pleasant Ridge Reserve. And it's Hatch Farms, and I'd been for the American Cheese Festival. Put this into context, a little while ago when I used to write, you know, snarky things on food chat boards like Chowhound back in the day, I once wrote something on there where I said America was where good cheese goes to die.
Right.
And that's a thought that I'd had about American cheese for a long, long time. And I think it's because, you know, cheese that traveled here from Europe often wasn't well kept, and cheese that was made here was probably made with more enthusiasm and experience because it was a craft that had been lost for a long time. That's certainly not true now. America is making world-class cheeses. And Pleasant Ridge Reserve, which is a previous winner of the best cheese at the American Cheese Conference, is one of those. And I went up to make it in Wisconsin, which is just beautiful part of the world. And I've been lucky enough now to go to every state, and I still think Wisconsin is one of the most gorgeous I've been to. And I went to make it with the cheesemaker there, Randy Hatch, who is one of the most dedicated people I've ever met in any craft business anywhere around the world. And we made the cheese together, and it is a wonderful, wonderful cheese. And I do recommend people going out now and really trying some of the cheeses, you know, whether it's from Vermont or Wisconsin or the West Coast, wherever you are. Another one is, you know, where better to eat a lobster roll than in New England, and it's always going to be perfect, and the people who made it for me there did an exquisite job, and we went out on the boats to catch the lobsters. And then making a beer, I made a beer called Fed, White, and Brew, and we entered it at the Great American Beer Festival, which is a huge thing now in the United States, and we ended up winning a bronze medal, which when you think there were 4,500 beers and maybe 80-something won a medal, was a real achievement. I still have that medal hanging up in my living room at home.
So, Simon, I guess this is the big question. You spent a year trying to, quote, find America with your fork. So what did you learn about America?
It's a great question and what I'm still working on. But I think I definitely learned some food things. I believe we're on the edge of a great golden age of food in America right now with, you know, the influence of immigrant populations, the rise of the craft movement, and definitely the fact that we're seeing great food now coming from all over the country. But you know what I really found out was about the people, and I think it really showed to me that Americans are all kinds of different people, and it's very hard to define what makes an American. It can be whatever you want it to be. But the one thing we all have in common is we all eat.
Simon, thank you so much. The book is a fascinating read. I'm so glad you could join us.
It was my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Simon Majumdar has written Fed, White, and Blue. Joe Yonan's latest book is Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. And you can find a list of Simon's top 10 American eats on the website, splendidtable.org. Think how many times a small tip or the nudge of an idea saves you some cash or maybe ups your cooking game. Well, every week we get those tips and nudges when we talk with the pros at America's Test Kitchen. This week it's Lisa McManus. Lisa heads up the equipment testing and ingredient tastings for America's Test Kitchen. Hey, Lisa, it's good to have you back with us.
It's great to be here.
Okay, so what's the latest merciless testing that you're doing?
This time we have just tested muffin tins, and we tested 10 different brands.
So what were you looking for?
Well, we were really looking for what makes the difference between, you know, can the pan make a difference to the muffin that you get, even if you use the same recipe, same ingredients, same oven, same cooking time. And we found that it really makes a huge difference. You know, sometimes you can get a muffin that looks like a cone on top, or it doesn't rise much at all. It looks really squat, and sometimes they come out too dark, or sometimes they come out too light. We really wanted to get to the bottom of that because we want your muffins to come out perfect, you know, tall, well-shaped, a good dome on the top, nice browning because that's flavorful, but not too much browning. And we want it to work every single time. So we looked at 10 different muffin tins and really went out of our way to make a lot of different muffins. We made basic muffins. We made cupcakes. We also made muffin tin frittatas because we really wanted to get at, you know, are some of these better for some things than others? The recipes that call for you to do different things, like maybe rotate the pan in the oven. Is that going to be easier or harder with some of these? And what did the final baked goods look like and taste like?
So what was the outcome? I guess what we really want to know is who won?
Well, what won was really interesting. It was a gold-colored nonstick pan by OXO. It's the OXO Good Grips Nonstick Pro 12-cup muffin pan. It's about $25. And what we really liked about it were a few traits that we really found were useful across the board. I mean, for one thing, the nonstick coating. We didn't want muffins and things to stick in there. When you turn that over or you want to lift it out, you don't want it to break and leave some behind.
Right.
Well, we had, you know, we had 10 muffin tins, and one of them we chose as not a nonstick. It had this finish that looked like snakeskin, and it was supposed to help with the release. It kind of did, but it kind of didn't. And we didn't, we just thought, forget it. We really like a nonstick coating. And then we really wanted ones that had, we discovered, a rim all the way around the, all four sides that extends out beyond those muffin cups. So that when you're reaching in with a pot holder, you're not sticking your thumb right into a muffin or cupcake that you just baked, or into the batter on the way into the oven.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you're going to rotate it in the oven, because we find that ovens heat much more in the back than they do in the front. They lose some heat through the door area. So by rotating, you get a more even bake across the sheet. But if they only have a little skimpy handle on one side, you had to reach all the way into the oven and turn it, and that was just too much. So we love this particular one because it has a broad rim on all four sides.
I see a lot of this gold-colored nonstick cookware out there. What is it about that particular coating?
Well, that was the third trait that really made a difference, was the color of the pan. And that was really the most interesting because, you know, some of these were a light silver color. We had three that were gold or bronze, three that were light or kind of medium silver, and four that were that classic dark nonstick, that charcoal gray color that you always see. Now, what we found was that the dark color ones would bake a little faster. The muffins would set on the edges where they contacted the pan, and then the middle would keep rising. So you get what looks like a little volcanic cone, you know, they erupt in the middle. And you get that funny looking shape, and sometimes kind of squat shape because they set before they could really rise. The light colored ones gave us light colored baked goods. The gold ones hit that sort of sweet spot in the middle, that Goldilocks, not too much, not too little, beautiful golden brown. So we really, the top three in our testing were all bronze or gold colored. And the bottom ones were pretty much darker, and then that one that was not nonstick.
So OXO was your first pick. What are the other two?
The second was Williams-Sonoma Gold Touch. That was the first brand that really came out with these gold-colored nonstick. And we have in the past really liked other pans that they make, like their loaf pan or round cake pans that give us a nice color on our baked goods. And we wondered, well, would that carry through to muffin tins? And it did. Mm-hmm. But we liked the design of the OXO a little bit more because it had that rim on all four sides for easy grabbing. And the third place was a bronze-colored one by Anilon, so called the Anilon Advanced Bronze Bakeware. It's a little darker than the other two, had little funky handles that weren't quite as good as that nice broad rim, but it's a pretty good pan for the browning and the right kind of rise.
So, Lisa, did you discover a reason why the gold worked better?
Yeah, we did, actually. We looked at the way heat works in an oven, and it radiates out in waves. And when the waves hit a pan, its atoms and molecules move faster, and that heats everything up. But different materials absorb heat waves at different rates. In general, darker objects absorb more heat waves than lighter objects, because the lighter objects reflect some of those waves. And now you've probably experienced this when you're wearing dark clothing on a sunny day versus a white blouse or something, where it will feel cooler because the lighter fabric is actually reflecting back some of those waves and absorbing less heat.
So the gold isn't too light and it isn't too dark.
That's right.
Really interesting. So we'll go for the gold. And thank you.
Anytime.
Lisa McManus heads up the equipment testing and ingredient tastings for America's Test Kitchen. Now try out that nonstick with their recipe for savory corn muffins. Find it on the website splendidtable.org. Coming up, your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time for us to connect. You can reach us by phone, 800-537-5252, or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Let's see. Susan is calling from Decatur in Georgia. Susan,
yes.
Hi, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about a bottle of port.
Ooh, tell me more.
Okay.
I like port a lot.
Well, its official title is a Taylor Fladgate Vintage Porto.
Ooh, yeah, this sounds very serious.
It is. It was 1992, bottled in 1994.
Uh-huh.
So the story is that a friend of Bill's who owned a wine merchant shop in Atlanta needed help one Saturday afternoon. And, of course, Bill went over and helped out and rang people out. And he came back with a few extra bucks in his pocket and this bottle of port. And we were, you know, fairly newly married at that point. And he said, this bottle is an investment in our future. We will uncork it at our 20th anniversary.
Uh-huh.
And then we discovered Splendid Table many years later.
And then you really got into trouble. Yes, exactly.
Yes, he said, let's just not just decant the bottle of porter, but let's figure out a meal to make around this bottle of port.
Ah, okay. Now, this is a brilliant idea, first of all. Let's just put that out on the table right away. Now, port is sweet, but the other thing is that port has wonderful nuances and richness, and this is going to be a very, very good port. So I'm trying to think, how are we going to set it off really brilliantly? A couple of things come to mind, and then we'll figure out a menu with them, okay?
Sounds good.
I'm personally a great fan of port with funky cheeses or strong cheeses. For instance, with a gorgonzola, you know, a blue cheese. Because, like, a port, you know, gorgonzola has soul. And there are other blue cheeses, too, that really have soul and a creaminess, a richness. That's one of the keys with port, that it's going to work very well with that creamy funkiness. Camembert would work really well with this. Taleggio, a good brie, a Livaro. But I'm talking about European cheeses right now, and really we've got so many great cheeses made in the United States. Anything that has, how can I put it? It's called a bloomy rind, and if you look at Camembert or you look at the rind on brie, that's a bloomy rind. It's a rind that they've done bacteria on it so that it helps the cheese develop certain flavors and to ripen in a certain way.
Got it.
So those kinds of cheeses, I mean, you could do that with on bread or crackers. And I think if you use that with a generous smear, and this could be dessert, by the way, or this could be the first part of a two-course dessert. So this would be after the main course. And you would sip that port with this. And you may want to have a couple of different cheeses. I mean, you may want to also have a cheddar, a really sharp cheddar. And then you may want to have something that's more of a fresh, creamy cheese, like a fresh sheep cheese. And then you'll see how that port kind of leans in different directions. You know what I mean?
Now, this sounds wonderful, going out, getting a baguette, and then just cheese shop.
You got it. But the other thing is that port is wonderful with chocolate, especially bittersweet chocolate and semi-sweet chocolates. And you could do a one of those flourless chocolate cakes or one of those very dense chocolate cakes. You could do something even like a chocolate cupcake, not too sweet, but a lot of chocolatiness, and where in the center you put a few chunks of just the chocolate so that when you bite into it, it's you know, this lovely surprise of the center having chocolate and nuts. So you may want to put in some almonds that you've toasted or pistachio nuts, which would be wonderful in that. So nuts, and the other thing is dried fruits. Now, this is what I'm thinking. How about if we were to do, I'm thinking of what the meat might be, but maybe it's not a meat. Maybe it's a fish. Or it could be a roast chicken, because this is what I'm thinking. If you, let's say we do a roast chicken, okay, for a minute.
Yes, I love roast chicken.
Okay. I do too. First of all, what I would do is butterfly it, okay? Mm-hmm. And I would slice up lemons and oranges, really thin rounds, okay? And I would sprinkle salt and pepper on both sides of the chicken. Do this ahead, okay? Mm-hmm. And then I would sprinkle them with a little bit of cinnamon and some black pepper. And then I would just pack those thin sliced pieces of citrus around both sides of this flat chicken, and I'd put it in the refrigerator overnight and just let that seep in. And then what I would do is I'd remove the lemon and the orange slices, and I'd put it on a rack, and I would roast it. Oh, I forgot. A bit of garlic never hurt. I would roast it. And then what it would be wonderful to do is with it, you do carrots that you've cut into bite-sized pieces, and you have dried apricots that you've cut into chunks and an onion that you've cut up. And you saute all of that in a bit of oil. Olive oil is really nice here. And then you add some white wine and some water, and you just let the carrots cook until they're tender, until a glaze forms. You just keep cooking down that liquid.
Excellent.
And you get that wonderful quality of the apricot, which is sort of tart and sweet, the dried apricot, and the sweetness of the carrots. And then you've got the citrusy chicken that has a fair amount of black pepper and cinnamon on it. And I think if you sip that port with that, and you may want to have something very simple, either rice or something like a simple steamed potato with a little bit of butter and chopped parsley. It sounds boring, but trust me, it is not. And that's your main course.
And steamed, but that sounds so wonderful. So all the flavor would be in the marinade of the lemons and oranges.
That's right. But you get just a suggestion of it in the chicken, because you don't want to overwhelm the port. And see what you think of that.
Right. That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And you're going to enjoy that port so much. Ah, it's wonderful.
I cannot wait. Yes. I can't wait.
There's a lot of envy floating around right now in the studio. Enjoy it, Susan. Congratulations. Go and celebrate.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You take care. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
You know, old ports like that, there's vintages on ports are not, they don't happen every year. Usually a maker will put a vintage on a bottle because they think it's a very special year for those grapes. And it's what they call a fortified wine, meaning some brandy is added to the wine and it's aged, and it can be just delicious, really delicious. But even something like a tawny port, a modest price one, California, Australia, etc., really, really delicious and unusual to have with cheese or to serve with something that's chocolatey, or as we talked about, something like a roast chicken or a piece of grilled salmon. You keep whatever you serve with it simple, because the port has a lot going on. But try it. You know, we all drink red wine and white wine and cider and that kind of thing. Try some port. Anyway, 800-537-5252. That's how you can get to us. And also, send me an email, splendidtable.org. Ryan is calling from Bristow, Virginia. Welcome, Ryan. What do you want to talk about?
I'd like to talk about tomato soup today. I've been married to my wife for 18 years. She loves tomatoes and especially loves tomato soup. And I've been looking for a recipe or some hints on ingredients that would really kind of up the wow factor.
Ah, how do you make the soup that she likes now, or soups that she really enjoys?
Well, I start just by buying kind of a variety of tomatoes and pan roasting those in the oven with some onion, and then taking those, adding it to some chicken stock, olive oil, in just a regular stock pot, and
right.
then simmering that with some bay leaves and so forth.
Oh, that sounds so good.
It smells wonderful. Yeah, it usually comes out pretty well, I think.
Yeah, because the idea of roasting, you know, the tomatoes is just going to up the intensity of the flavor. Well, okay, let's just say we can fool around with that idea. Okay, one of the ways that I like to do now, for instance, does your wife like Asian flavors by any chance?
Sure. Yeah,
because there's a couple of things you can do that are really fun. If you start out with, let's say for argument's sake, a nice sized yellow onion, right? Mm-hmm. Or a white one or a red one. It doesn't matter. A bit of oil, doesn't have to be olive oil, bottom of a saucepan or, you know, a pot like it's about 6 quarts. And then what you want to do is saute that onion and get it to the point where it's browning. And then you've taken, okay, while you're prepping, about a 2-inch piece of fresh ginger and about 4 cloves of garlic. And you've just thrown that in a food processor or a blender and you've, you know, let her rip. You want to mince that down. Okay. And does your wife like things that have a little spice, a little chili or not?
No, she's not too big on spice.
Okay. She doesn't need to be. There's no necessity for that.
Okay.
So we've got this base, and then what you do is you're going to saute that, and then you're going to add, now this is the time of year I like to use good canned tomatoes. I lean toward the organic ones, but use whatever you use. Buy the whole peeled tomatoes, and then you can break them up with your hand, because sometimes when you get into crushed and that kind of thing, some tomato paste has been added to it. And it's usually not a super good tomato paste. And it can throw off the flavor. And I'm going to get a lot of letters from tomato canners telling me about how wrong I am. But the reality is, start out with whole canned tomatoes and you'll be doing just swell. So you add about a 28-ounce can to that. And then what you can do if you want to is you can add to that a little bit of coconut milk, like a half a cup, okay? Mm-hmm. And you let that simmer for half hour, okay? And you're tasting as you're going. And you could add a dash of soy sauce to it, just like a 2 teaspoons of soy sauce, or fish sauce, which is really funky. But boy, does it do fabulous things. Really fabulous things. And then what you do is you can puree it and, or you can leave it chunky and you serve it hot or cold, but you're going to sprinkle a squeeze of fresh lime over it and see what she thinks. And if you may want to add more ginger, you may want to add more garlic, you know, you can fool around with it any way you like. Mm-hmm. You may want to add a little crushed mint when you serve it, because mint is really interesting with tomatoes. Or the other thing you could do is even saute some almond slivers and sprinkle that over the top and then squeeze on the lime. But it's different.
Oh, that sounds nice.
Yeah. But, you know, you can take any herb and you could continue roasting the tomatoes, too. And you can roast canned tomatoes. You drain them. And they roast up really nicely with some olive oil and or any kind of oil. But the thing is, for instance, you can do a dill tomato soup by adding a lot of fresh dill. And a Scandinavian touch would maybe to be finish it off with some really rich whole milk yogurt. You know, a few spoonfuls in each bowl and you stir it in. And, you know, any herb that you can think of, you can use in that tomato soup to change it. Just that basic thing you've been doing.
Okay. Yeah, and I hadn't thought about the whole milk yogurt. That would take out some of the acidity. Definitely.
Yeah, exactly. And if you start, you know, the canned tomatoes can be really delicious, especially when we can't get super duper, you know, fresh ones that are really sweet and delicious. But see what she thinks, okay?
I will do that.
All right.
Thank you so much for them.
You sound like a really great husband.
I try.
Very impressive. Hey, thanks, Ryan. Take care.
Thanks.
Remember, you can call us anytime, 800-537-5252, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Well, that's the show for this week. Great to have you with us. Sally Swift, our managing producer, is going to be here next week. The week after, it is the brilliant Frances Lam, my soon-to-be successor. Now, the rumor is that at this very moment, Frances is in his kitchen working up a new Key 3. Now, the Key 3 is our series with our favorite cooks. Each one believes their three key recipes will make better cooks of us all. Talk about collecting wisdom. In the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Aesop of fable fame, who said, "A crust eaten in peace is better than a banquet partaken in anxiety." Now, if you like what you heard here today, subscribe to our podcast, follow us on Instagram and Pinterest, and, as always, you can find information on everything you heard here today at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.